very busy. Many important matters require a king's attention.
I'm king now. King now.
I am king.
I am
king.
I am
kiss it.
I am
kiss it again.
I am your fingers or your
king. Doesn't
fingers
discuss
your
battle plans.
He's one.
But girls.
Your fingers or your tongue.
I am the king. I'm telling mother.
Welcome to the Joffrey Podcast. My name's Bubba, and with me, as always, is you. The double L, the loyal listener who's been with us through several years of Game of Thrones coverage, covering His Grace King Joffrey, first of his name, first in your hearts. I'm going to be talking about some of the latest Game of Thrones news in a bit, but really this podcast is to let you guys hear our new Mandalorian Parsec Passion podcast. Ooh, that's a lot of P's that are popping right there. Yeah, we're doing a podcast about The Mandalorian, the new Disney Plus show, the first live-action Star Wars show ever. And we want to let you guys know about it and tell you it's not going to be on this feed, obviously. This is a feed reserved for His Grace. If you want to download it, go to our social media sites on Twitter at DoublePHQ. That's the word double, the single letter P, and then the letters HQ for headquarters. Or you can go to Facebook.com/DoublePHQ and it'll point you to the right place. Or just go to your favorite podcast app, including the one you're on right now, and search for Mandalorian Parsec Passion. Parsec is P-A-R-S-E-C. Parsec Passion, and you can download it. It's Catfish and I traveling to a galaxy far, far away to talk about this new $100 million entry to fill the Game of Thrones size hole in our TV viewing habits. Before we play that podcast for you and let you have a taste of us, I thought I'd cover real quickly some of the big Game of Thrones / A Song of Ice and Fire / Westeros Planetos news that has happened over the last week and a half. HBO canceled the Blood Moon, a.k.a. Age of Heroes, a.k.a. Long Night series that they had been planning and filmed a pilot for, starring Naomi Watts and Miranda Richardson. My take? I always thought it was an odd choice, mainly because it didn't have dragons, and the White Walker threat, theoretically, we see how it ends in Game of Thrones, so how could the Long Night give us anything new if we know the White Walkers wouldn't be defeated? The one positive thing about the series was that, yes, a wall had to be built to separate Westeros from the lands of Always Winter, but how it got built, why it got built, who built it, you could do anything with it. The great thing about Game of Thrones is even though it was based on these wonderful books by George R.R. Martin, no one in the audience knew the ending. And so even though it had approximately 5-6 years of material from the books that people could know and assume where stuff was going to go, no one knew how it ended, so you could be engaged. That is another positive about the Long Night, Age of Heroes, Blood Moon series that they ended up canceling, is that the audience would never know. You would still have all that fun speculation, the people getting involved. So it's odd that they're canceling that show and the positives it had for a show that kind of has the exact opposite scenario. HBO is moving forward with a show entitled House of the Dragon about the Targaryens based on George's Fire and Blood book series. Now, of course, what's positive about that is it's closer to the world the television viewing audience knows. It features dragons. Hey, Game of Thrones dragons go hand in hand. Unlike the Long Night Age of Heroes series, which, if you believe the lore, couldn't have had any dragons, this can have plenty of dragons, plenty of special effects, burning down cities and armies like they would do hundreds of years later in Game of Thrones. Of course, the negative thing about the House of Dragon is we know who's going to sit this throne, who's going to win each and every battle. So unlike Game of Thrones and unlike Blood Moon, Age of Heroes, House of the Dragon, we know who will always be on the throne. We know who's going to marry who. These lineages can't suddenly change, you wouldn't assume, just because we need to shock the audience. The audience couldn't be shocked anymore. Any audience member who wants to know what would happen with this royal line could go to any Wikipedia page and say, okay, this person follows this person in this year. Yes, this is a written history, and Martin always likes to say the history could be written wrong. But generally, you would assume the history would be correct, and they're not going to say person A ended up on the throne and person B died, and then the show do anything different. So House of the Dragon, for all its positives, oh boy, where's the drama in what we already know is going to happen? You could argue back, well, wait a minute, we already knew Ned Stark was going to lose his head. There was still a lot of drama there, and I'll grant you that. But I still think House of the Dragon has a couple of just inherent troublemaking issues to have it be a long-running show, especially one that could be as hot and as successful as HBO wants it to be for the Game of Thrones successor show. One final bit of Game of Thrones news that's adjacent to all this series talk is, of course, David Benioff and D.B. Weiss, Stan Weiss, leaving the Star Wars project. This has been rumored about for years. If you listen to a lot of Star Wars podcasts, and specifically start listening to the Mandalorian Parsec Passion podcast that we're putting out right now, you would have heard these grumblings, these rumors that Dan and Dave were going to leave Star Wars months ago. Now, you could read the trades and you hear all the reasons why people suspect they might have left this project and Disney might have wanted them to leave the project. But I want to jump to kind of bigger picture and have a little Game of Thrones essay right now. An essay which I don't think a lot of podcasters, and I still listen to all our Game of Thrones podcasting friends, I don't think a lot of people just talk about and aren't honest with themselves about. For example, I listened to a great podcast that tends to be book-focused, where they were talking about, yeah, you know, George will have the Battle of King's Landing first, and then the White Walker problem second. And I hear these people who have been presented as expert on these books talking for the longest time of, oh, that's the way it has to go in the books. George won't screw up like the show did. It'll be King's Landing first, White Walker second. And I'm just scratching my head thinking, oh, are you guys paying attention to how this story works? If you step back a bit, that makes literally no sense. You're going to have Daenerys and Drogon destroy King's Landing, commit terrible atrocities, and then she's going to go fight the White Walkers with the dragons? That it isn't logical. It doesn't make sense. Would Jon Snow kill Daenerys if the last thing he's seen her do is fight the army of the dead, the White Walkers, the others? No, of course he wouldn't. Okay, she did destroy King's Landing and kill all those people, but she just redeemed herself by helping us fight the army of the dead. It can't go that way at all. Another thing we've heard since the final season aired, it's just constant attacks on Dan and Dave. If you didn't like season 8, I'm not here to tell you you have to like it or you should like it. What I do want to talk about now in this little mini podcast essay is the thought of a writer of what they had to do and the big challenges facing them on the show, as well as George R.R. Martin in about 15 years whenever he thinks about writing these books. After season 6, there were so many characters, so many things to do, but really, if you look at big picture bullet points, there really weren't that many. One, Cersei had to fall. Cersei was always going to fall. House Lannister was always going to fall. That's one thing that had to happen. Number two, the Army of the Dead had to be defeated. They were never going to win. If you read the series, watched the show, and thought the Army of the Dead and the White Walkers would win, you may have had a misreading, let's be completely honest. So that's two. Next up at number three, Jon Snow and Daenerys had to meet and fall in love. Four, Daenerys had to reach an emotional breaking point to where she would burn down and destroy King's Landing and commit terrible atrocities. And then finally, Jon Snow had to kill Daenerys. I want to focus on those third and fourth points. And I want you to put yourself in the writer's shoes. They had to have Jon Snow and Daenerys fall in love. And they had to have the audience want them to fall in love, while also setting up that Daenerys was slowly breaking, and soon would do a terrible atrocity and kill hundreds of thousands of people in King's Landing. Those two things aren't compatible. If Daenerys had signs that she was really, really becoming evil, the audience would be like, John, don't end up with her. She's turning bad. She's breaking bad. The showrunners decided to push Daenerys' breaking point to later and later and later in the series. Once again, let's get through this. So Jon Snow and Daenerys had to meet, fall in love, and then Jon Snow had to kill her. So many complaints I hear about the last two seasons, and I have plenty of complaints about the last two seasons. Don't get me started on the White Hunt. I'm talking to you, Pat Man. Jon Snow and Daenerys had to meet, they had to fall in love, and Jon had to kill her. They budgeted 7 episodes of season 7, 6 episodes of season 8, giving them 13 episodes to have Jon and Daenerys meet, fall in love, and then Jon kill her. And I know I can hear so many people screaming, oh, that's not enough, that's not enough. Yes, but back in season 1, Daenerys met Khal Drogo, fell in love with Khal Drogo, and ends the season by killing Khal Drogo. That was in just a single 10-episode season. Those beats happened across just 10 episodes, and technically, let's be honest, less than 10, because Daenerys didn't appear in every single episode of season 1. So they were able to get there in just 10 episodes. Let's give them even the episode that they don't appear in, sure. So personally, I think it's very easy to see how Dan and Dave could be sitting down to map out the final two seasons and say, all right, Daenerys and Jon Snow will meet, they'll fall in love, and then he'll kill her. But instead of 10 episodes, let's do it in 13, including 13 supersized episodes. The hard part was, once again, they need the audience to want Jon and Daenerys to fall in love. They need the audience to believe in this love so that the tragedy of Jon killing Daenerys pays off. So once again, to have the audience fight for this relationship, what do? They have to keep Daenerys, quote-unquote, on the good guy's side up until she has to snap. And I honestly think that makes a logical sense, but for many viewers, it didn't pay off well. I would think if you asked David Benioff and Dan Weiss, where were the hints that Daenerys could break bad like this, could commit something like this, they would say, well, what about in season 7 when she did the double T? Double D? Tarly toasting, a.k.a. the double R. Double R, Randall roasting, and the double D. Double D, Dickon's death. They would say these were prisoners who had surrendered. Just because they wouldn't bend the knee, Daenerys roasted them alive. That's a sign. Audience, that's a sign that, hey, she might break bad at the end. Of course, it didn't really register with the audience. They may have wanted the audience to see, ooh, Daenerys has got some kind of evilness in her. But most of the audience just thought, Randall's an a-hole. Okay, he burned, big whoop. Dickon seemed like a nice guy, but we really didn't spend too much time with him. And so in my own writer's brain, I'm thinking, well, how could you have Daenerys break bad and yet Jon still fall in love with her? How could you signal that she had so much anger inside her and was willing to do something like she does in King's Landing? And so one thing I've always thought is, well, rather than just Tarly toasting and Randall roasting and Dickon dying, what if Daenerys came out to those people after the loot train attack and said, a lot of you Lannister forces have run away hoping to fight me another day. I need your word, every single one of you here, that you will bend the knee and respect my authority. If just one of you decides against bending the knee to my reign, all of you will die. I can't keep fighting you. So it's kneel or death. To me, raising the stakes where a lot of innocent soldiers, admittedly extras, red shirts, would get roasted because Randall and later Dickon and maybe a few other extras decide not to bend the knee, that is a better sign of the atrocities that she could do. What do you guys think? How easy is it to have Jon and Daenerys fall in love and the audience swoon over their romance while also showing the emotional anger at the center of Daenerys that could come out at any moment? It's just a thought. It's just a question. Write to us at DoublePHQ on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook.com/DoublePHQ, and tell us what you think. Are you happy that we're getting House of the Dragon? Are you heartbroken that Blood Moon, a.k.a. Age of Heroes, a.k.a. The Long Night, isn't going forward? And I'm totally up for anybody's thoughts. If you need to write longer things, Facebook.com/DoublePHQ. How could you have made that transition work? Daenerys slowly breaking bad, hints of breaking bad, hints of doing terrible atrocities, while also keeping the love that Jon and Daenerys needed to have for each other to set up the heartbreaking stabbing in the end. Okay, we've talked Game of Thrones a bit. Now it's time to get into Star Wars The Mandalorian. I hope you like this podcast, Mandalorian Parsec Passion. Find it on your iTunes and Stitcher, all podcast apps, rate and review. We really do need you. You're the one who makes this show go, so please follow us to these new podcasts. And until then, may the Force be with you, and I'm telling Mother!
They sent you were the best in the Parsec.
Welcome to
Parsec Passion,
a podcast about The Mandalorian on Disney+. My name's Bubba, and with me is one of the vilest bounty hunters in all the galaxy. It's Catfish. Catfish, how are you doing this evening?
Very excited to start this podcast and series.
We are taking a look at the new Disney Plus series, The Mandalorian, the first live-action Star Wars show. We are so, so excited. Created by executive producer Jon Favreau from all his great work on the Marvel films and Disney remakes, starring Pedro Pascal, a.k.a. Oberyn Martell, the Red Viper from Game of Thrones. Catfish, right at the top, what are you thinking about this? Are you excited? Are you happy that Star Wars is coming to the small screen?
I'm excited about it. I mean, I think it is a great world that I'm interested in that was filled out. We got a sense of the larger world in the Skywalker saga, and we've had a couple other smaller movies that were sort of tangentially related to the Skywalker saga. I think we can stand to see some of the rest of this universe. I'm excited about it, but based on seeing the trailers, looks like it has, as I'm not surprised, has great production value. So I just hope that the plot will match up to it. Now, what about you?
Catfish, I am so excited. They are filming this. This is hard to believe. Just down the street in Manhattan Beach from your place. Don't you want to go and say, knock, knock, hey, can I be a stormtrooper and get shot? This reminds me of when I was a kid playing with my action figures. I was always about characters who were badass and would shoot guns. And Boba Fett was one of the ones I certainly gravitated to just because of his cool costume, IG-88, just because he was there with Boba Fett. And so Jon Favreau seems to be creating a series based on all the things I did with my action figures when I was a little kid.
Well, I hope he hasn't stolen any of your ideas.
Oh my God. Don't do it, Jon Favreau. Don't do it.
Hands off, JF.
So, Catfish, I think we need to tell everybody that we are part of the Double P Media family. And you can talk to us on our Facebook page, facebook.com/DoublePHQ. That's the word double, the single letter P, then the letters HQ for headquarters. At facebook.com/DoublePHQ. We're also on Twitter and Instagram at DoublePHQ. We want to hear from you. This show is by fans, for fans. We want you guys to tell us what you're excited about this $100 million television production. Disney's got some pockets.
They do. I think they are coming out of the gate strong. They have got so many. I was initially skeptical, Bubba, of the Disney Plus service. I don't have any kids, and so I thought, I don't know, but I think they are going to dominate. I would guess that within the first year, they will be second only to Netflix, I think.
I do too, and this, The Mandalorian, is their signature show. It's the one they're launching with, the one they're trying to get those adults who are going to be paying the monthly subscription fees to the kids to get it. And we're going to talk more about the streaming services in a bit. I think we need to go ahead and, for our listeners, go ahead and state our Star Wars credentials, our Star Wars story, how we got hooked into George Lucas's billion-dollar empire. And I'll go first. I was a very, very, very young kid in 1977. My uncle took my older sister and I, because he wanted to see this movie and he didn't have any kids at the time, to the Terra Theater in Atlanta, which is still a theater that exists. I was so young when I saw that film in 77. I came out of the film and I just pretty much said, I like robots. That's all I knew about it. I couldn't comprehend the rest. Over the next year that it was in theaters, my sister and my younger sister and I, we ended up seeing this film 10 times in the theaters. I remember it was 10 because we stood in line for an hour one time at a mall to get tickets, and right when we got to the very front of the line, the theater sold out, so we couldn't see it 11 times. I saw the holiday special, which featured the very first appearance of the Mandalorian armor that Boba Fett wears. Then, because my family was moving in 1980, I only actually saw The Empire Strikes Back once in the theater. If you were a kid back then, that was painful to only see the movie once, but like I said, my family was moving over the summer. But for 3 years straight, me and every kid on the playground, we were debating, is Luke Darth Vader's son? No, Darth Vader's lying. We debated it for 3 years. When Return of the Jedi came out, my sisters and I, we said we have to see it as soon as we could. So a Friday right after school, we got taken to the Savannah Mall to see one of the first showings of Return of the Jedi. When we exited the theater, the local Savannah News came down and interviewed us because they were like, hey, people have already seen the film. And my sister and I were on the local news talking about, oh, we love Jedi. Jump forward to the prequels. I lived in Los Angeles. I'm seeing them at the Chinese theater, and they were tough. They were very, very tough. Let's be honest. I honestly think
now, which one did we see, Bubba? Because I think we saw these together, but one of them we saw at the Cinerama Dome.
Ooh. So I think it might have been the third one we saw.
All right.
Anyway, so the prequels came around. I think there were great story ideas in there, and if you focus on the positives of the prequels, they can be really fun. Like a lot of people, I had trouble with some of those prequel moments, including the awkward love story in all the films, but I still kept the passion up. I still loved it. It was still fun bonding with people over Star Wars. Now Disney has come back with their films, and I love, love, love The Force Awakens. As soon as I exited the theater at The Force Awakens with, once again, my sisters, because we wanted to make it like old times when we were kids, I immediately said to them, let's just go see it again right now. There have maybe been diminishing returns on some of the Disney films since then, but I'm still all in, and it feels like this Mandalorian show, once again, Jon Favreau, feels like he's making it for people my age and for people who want to see some badass action in this world. So that's my Star Wars story. Catfish, take us through your trip into a galaxy far, far away.
Now, I also remember having seen the first one a few times. At this time, I lived in a very small town near Westerly, Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. And they had a small theater there called the United Theater, where I remember seeing it at least three times. Then, you know, I am not as a dedicated fan as you. I saw all the first trilogy, the first film trilogy, the second part, episodes 4, 5, and 6. I saw them two or three times in the theater, enjoyed them. So therefore, very, very disappointed by the last episodes 1, 2, and 3. I had a lot of problems with the writing and the acting. And some of those people were very good actors. And when you see a good actor who doesn't seem to be doing very well, that's either because the director can't direct actors or doesn't really care about directing actors. So I'm not sure which they fell under there. But I was very underwhelmed by those. Also, it's funny, watching those, I thought to myself, you know, in the future, someone coming to this series might, and probably should, if you're going to do it, watch the episodes in order. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Well, just as you were talking about, the biggest reveal back in the olden days, next to Who Shot JR, was that Darth Vader was Luke Skywalker's father. Now, if someone watching this now watches it, by the time they get to that reveal, they're going to go, yeah, of course he is. And that was such a big deal in those movies and how it affected Luke and his struggle. That's completely taken away by having, you know, episodes 1, 2, and 3. But mostly I was just troubled by the writing and the bad story. And then when it came down to this set of films, love it. I loved the first one, Force Awakens. Obviously, I think a lot of people have complained because there's a lot of similarities sort of between that, you know, and A New Hope as far as finding the one kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But I thought it was great. I thought the performances were great. I loved the story. I loved the second one in the last trilogy. I dug Rogue One just for the same reasons that I think I'm going to dig The Mandalorian, and that it's like, you know, I'm happy to see more stories set in this world. And I don't even need it to be attached to the Skywalker saga the way kind of Rogue One was.
Yeah, well, Catfish, you are setting us up, I think, on the next thing we have to do, something every single person in the world does at one time or another, and that's give people our Star Wars films rankings.
Okay, let's do it.
Obviously, these are personal. Hopefully, yours are different from ours. We love a variety of opinions, but I'll go first. And as that kid who, when he saw Empire Strikes Back, when I saw Empire Strikes Back as a little kid back in 1980, I was kind of shocked. Wait, the movie ended? Wait, aren't they going to go rescue Han? I kind of thought that would be the end of the movie. It's like there'd be another adventure of them rescuing Han, but I had to wait another film. This is a long way of saying that Empire Strikes Back is my number one.
I'm just going to jump in here, Bubba, because it is my number one as well. The humor in it is amazing. I mean, you can have a very funny movie. There's humor sprinkled throughout, you know, the episodes 4, 5, and 6. But this one just does it so good.
It really, really does. The tension is so good. It introduces this Mandalorian armor, which has led to this point where we get the Mandalorian. So wonderful. Even the puppet work, which back then was certainly so difficult, and you had to hide it by shooting in kind of a dark set with fog. It was great by Jim Henson. Wonderful, wonderful stuff. My second film on my countdown is Star Wars A New Hope.
Mm-hmm.
The original, saw it 10 times. Enough can't be said about how it affected those kids who saw it in 1977. It was so unlike anything that had ever been before. My third, I'm actually going to go with the first film of this new trilogy, The Force Awakens. Catfish mentioned it a second ago. There are almost too many story beats and similarities to the original Star Wars, but I think J.J. Abrams, people have to give him credit for creating characters like Rey that are just wonderful, and you like them immediately, finding actors that you hadn't seen before, like John Boyega or Daisy Ridley, and making them work. I think The Force Awakens, if you subtract points for its story beat similarities to A New Hope, you add those points back in when you just think about how much fun it was to watch. Number four, and this might be a shocker, I'm going to the prequels, the third of the prequels, Revenge of the Sith.
This is so wrong. Okay.
Revenge of the Sith has problems. But as I thought, as soon as I watched it, almost, and let me say this is again, almost all of the problems of Revenge of the Sith spring from the first two films not getting the audience the point where it needed to be. Revenge of the Sith started as if the audience was very invested in Padme and Anakin's relationship, where because it had been so awkward and possibly poorly acted by both actors in the previous films, it really just didn't work. But that said, when I think about a Star Wars and I think about action, special effects, cinematography, all this stuff, I think the best scene of just two people talking is the Palpatine Anakin scene in the opera house. It is just two people talking. There's no, obviously there's some special effects, but there's not crazy action. The score is very minimal, but incredibly effective. At that moment, you can actually see great acting in a Star Wars film. So for me, Revenge of the Sith, number four, very shocking. Number five, Return of the Jedi. I think there's a jumbled mess that the film is as it tries to wrap up all the story beats, something that people may have seen in this last season of the HBO show Game of Thrones. Trying to wrap everything up, sometimes story beats get jumbled and messed and hurried along so you can get to the end. But in the positives, Return of the Jedi introduced one of the greatest characters ever, Jabba the Hutt, and also just has a lot of fun. If it was a bit too light for the situation that was going to happen, seeing Luke get electrocuted in front of his father, that raised the tension up enough to forgive the here we go another Death Star routine. My number six film on my list is Rogue One. And this is another film which I think really has problems, but you can't watch those final 30 minutes and not think, holy crap, this is great action. And like you, Catfish, I think this could really be a good template for what we're going to see in The Mandalorian. Number seven on my list, The Last Jedi. To me, The Last Jedi feels like the antithesis of the prequels, meaning that it has great directing, it has great acting, it has great moments. But when you pull back and look at the story of The Last Jedi as a whole, you're kind of like, huh? These beats didn't add up. Luke Skywalker, who we had watched three films, over 6 hours worth of screen time watching Luke grow into a person who was a Jedi who threw down his lightsaber and was willing to let himself be killed rather than turn to the dark side. Suddenly, he's willing to drop a lightsaber on Kylo Ren, his nephew's head, while he was sleeping? Now, yes, you could say, okay, a character could change. I'm okay with a character changing, but you have to show me. You have to get me emotionally believing in the fact that this character who I saw grow over six films had this momentary weakness where he snapped and was going to stab his nephew while he slept with a lightsaber. The movie didn't get that to me. It felt like it was trying to tell me that he turned rather than show me why Luke turned and had this bad moment.
Yeah.
And so even though I know some people love it, for me, The Last Jedi, I'm going to have it number 7. Number 8 is Solo, a very slight film, purposely slight, as a fun mission. There's some great effects, great moments. I tip my cap to Alden Ehrenreich. It's tough to be Harrison Ford. My final two, I'm going to go Attack of the Clones and Phantom Menace, both for all the reasons everybody knows. Why is Phantom Menace the bottom of mine? Once again, it goes to story. I think you could flip-flop these two as the two worst, but in my opinion, that if you kind of remove everything out of it, the story of Attack of the Clones generally makes sense. And you're like, okay, that's a through line. It wasn't executed well, but that's a through line. Where the story of The Phantom Menace really just has some leaps where you as an audience kind of have to figure out things on your own because the story never had a plan for them. What exactly was the trade dispute, which is the very first thing mentioned in the movie? Who was on what side? Why was it important? The movie never bothers to tell you. Apparently, the movie didn't consider it that important if it doesn't tell you what the actual trade dispute was. They were raising tariffs on trade routes. And so why did the Trade Federation blockade Naboo? These answers are in auxiliary material like books or comic books, but not in the actual story of the film. And then let's get to Jar Jar. God bless him. I met Ahmed Best one time in an Apple store at the Grove in Los Angeles. Great guy, did a great job with all he could, but somebody should have seen that performance and said, this isn't working. So that's my ranking, Catfish. I've gone on forever, but this is something, like I said, everybody seemingly on the internet does at one time or another. What is your ranking? And we know Empire's number one. What is your ranking of the Star Wars films?
Well, I feel like you're pretty close here. You're pretty close.
I tried.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate that. I appreciate that. And I can't help with there's some quirks of your upbringing, which have you, putting some things down incorrectly.
Oh, no.
Now, I would say that when I rank these, I can't rank them by, like, what's the best movie or is it the plot? You know, these are experience movies. And so it's kind of like the impact that they had on me at the time or the impact that they still have with me, you know, not as quote unquote, you know, movies, films, whatever. So that's why, my list may be a little bit different here. So again, I have Empire Strikes Back number 1. I also have A New Hope number 2.
Well, you got the first two right.
I did. Number 3, I had to go, and you'll see this is, you know, when I search my heart, there things are sort of in clumps here. So, yes, number 3 is Return of the Jedi.
Ooh, the original trilogy, 1, 2, 3.
There are, right, except, of course, I put them in the 2, 1, 3. But, okay, I mean, yes, Ewoks, I understand. But, understand, at the time, I mean, I know that you're right that there's a lot going on there and they're really trying to tie things up. But, you know, I didn't walk out of that movie going, like, I'm unhappy with how this trilogy ended. And maybe it's just because I was younger and I would take whatever. But I was like, yes, great. It was satisfying end of that movie. Sad that it is going to go. And then 4th, I put, showing my excitement for new stories in this, I put Rogue One.
Oh, wow.
So I have it 4th. And then 5th, I have 5th, The Last Jedi, Episode 8, which you have, you can kind of lower. Mostly the emotional, that kind of stuff, kind of really, really, really hit me. And so that one I put there, and then I put The Force Awakens 6th. Then 7th, I put Solo. Like you, I feel like there was so much going on with that movie. I mean, outside the movie.
Yeah.
That just took away from just what it was, which was a fun romp. I mean, I feel like as there are more and more Star Wars stories set in this universe, that maybe there won't be so much emphasis on each one to be something that's everything. A fun romp is well received in these quarters. And then number eight.
I put,
you didn't have it on your list, but you mentioned it earlier. It's the 1978 holiday special. Introducing Chewbacca's father, Itchy, and his son named Lumpy.
Oh, yes.
There's singing, there's dancing, there's comedy with Harvey Korman and Bea Arthur in it. So as horrible as that sounds, that is still above the last three that I have, which are the prequel film.
Ouch.
And I have them Number 9, Attack of the Clones. Number 10, Revenge of the Sith. That's our biggest disagreement. You've got it all the way at 4. And then obviously you have to put number 11, as you did correctly, Phantom Menace, after not just the movie, not just that, but after years and years. And then the excitement. Oh, my God, mm-hmm. It's coming back. We're going to have the prequel. And then to have what we got was just, I was crestfallen.
Man, and, I understand. And, I understand, yeah.
So that's it. That's the definitive ranking.
Catfish, I got to say, throwing in the Star Wars Holiday Special really has thrown me for a loop. What I want to say to our younger listeners, and I almost feel like all our listeners have to be younger, is the Star Wars Holiday Special is terrible, but it was very much of a piece with everything that was on TV at the time.
There was a variety show. There right. was like the Sonny and Cher show.
Donnie and Marie. People However, did this corny stuff all the time.
It has never been rebroadcast or made available. There are pirated, there's ways you can see it in a pirated fashion, but it cannot be seen officially in any form.
It had 3PO dancing. It's called the Star Wars Holiday Special because there isn't Christmas in a galaxy far, far away. Instead, they were celebrating the Wookiee Holiday Life Day. And once again, it is crazy, terrible, watched with modern eyes, actually watched with eyes back then. But it was so much of a piece with all those terrible variety shows that were on back then that I honestly think if you played it in between a Sonny and Cher and a Donnie and Marie or any of those other terrible variety shows, I think it would fit right in.
It would. It's Donnie, Marie, and Chewbacca. That's what it is.
Okay, we've given you our list of the Star Wars films. We want to hear from you. What's your ranking of the Star Wars films? In this one, let's go straight to Twitter. If you tweet us at PHQ, your ranking of all the Star Wars films, we're going to retweet it. We're going to see if we can get to a consensus that I'm right and Catfish is wrong. Catfish, I want to get to another point, which you've kind of already mentioned. And that is this is a new streaming service. Disney Plus, at the time of us recording this podcast, it doesn't exist yet. This will be released on the world on November 12th, and it's entering a very crowded lineup. We have Netflix, as you mentioned. We have Hulu. Amazon has a streaming service. Just this week, Apple TV launched a streaming service. We're going to have Disney Plus. Soon there's going to be a new streaming service called HBO Max, which has just announced that they'll be launching a Game of Thrones prequel series. So this is big business. This is the way.
You're not even mentioning a streaming service that I actually have, which is called Shudder.
Oh, great point. Yeah. Tell everybody what Shudder is.
Well, Shudder is niche and intentionally niche. I hope it survives. It's just like $5 a month or $45 a year or something. And it's horror focused. They do mostly horror. They have Joe Bob producing movies and giving, short stories about them. They have The Return of Creepshow is back. They have a lot of things that are exclusive. They mm-hmm. have a lot of old ones. They had this zombie movie in Japan that was like the number one movie last year called One Cut of the Dead, which is a hilarious behind the scenes. It's like a zombie. It's a combination of a zombie movie and Noises Off.
Oh, wow. I love Noises Off. That's great.
Yeah. It's the film version of Noises Off. Using a zombie.
Well, Catfish, you mentioned a great point. You mentioned a niche streaming service. There's a bunch that I'm interested in, including BritBox and Acorn TV, which have all those great British TV mysteries, which I grew up loving as a kid. So my question to you, and you've already said it, is you feel like Disney's going to launch in and jump to the second streaming service people have. How many services can people have? And what is the breaking point before people say, okay, I can only go with Netflix and Disney Plus, or I have Amazon because I get the Amazon Prime membership anyway.
Right.
So I'll have that in Disney Plus. What does Disney Plus need to do to convince people to add this service and possibly drop another one?
What they can do, I think, is what they've already done, which is been in business making movies and television for children and adults for 70 years. Their back catalog is incredible. And they're starting off with a price point of, is it $5.99?
You can get deals. I've got a deal where it's under $5 for me a month.
Yeah, so it is. I think it's got the deep bench already. It's got a deep bench of movies that people love. I mean, I think in the past, you know, people who had kids would buy DVDs. Now you don't have to buy any DVDs. You've got that catalog open, or Netflix had a lot of children's programming. But basically, Disney has, knowing they were doing this, has taken back all the rights to all their properties, and now they've got everything. I think they have everything they need already. And frankly, I wouldn't be surprised if their rate goes up in the next year. I mean, they've got what everybody wants.
Let's point out that Disney Plus and Disney Entirely is offering bundled deals where you could get Disney Plus, Hulu, and ESPN Plus all at a discounted rate if you get all three. They're going in whole hog, and as I've already mentioned, they've spent $100 million on this 10-episode series, The Mandalorian, to launch it all off. They're not dipping their toes in. They're diving in cannonball to the deep end of the pool.
Speaking of deep, you kind of, as a joke, sent a text around showing some movies that Disney Plus was going to have, some old Disney movies that maybe 10 people on the planet have heard of. I mean, they've got crap going back years and years.
They do. Listeners, write to us on social media. Tell us if you've got Disney Plus, if you're using a deal like through Verizon to get Disney Plus, if you're borrowing a buddy's password to get Disney Plus. Tell us what it took for you to get on board this new streaming service option. Once again, we're facebook.com/doublephq and on Twitter and Instagram @doublephq. Catfish, moving on, let's get specifically back to The Mandalorian, the show we're going to be breaking down every episode. This is a show where, based on the trailers we've seen, and we'll talk about the trailers in a bit, based on the trailers we've seen, the promotional art material, The Mandalorian hasn't taken off his helmet. We know he's portrayed by actor Pedro Pascal, or at least his voice is by actor Pedro Pascal. Catfish, can you invest emotionally? Can you enjoy a show where possibly the lead character is a voice behind a suit of armor? Can you enjoy a television movie version, the equivalent of Judge Dredd the comic, where that character never took off his helmet? What do you think?
Except in the...
Sylvester Stallone, right?
Well, no, and then I saw the one that had McCoy in it.
Carl Urban, he took off his mask in that one?
He did. I can't remember if he took off his mask, but it wasn't covering his whole face. In other words, it was more like a Centurion mask, so you could see his eyes and his mouth. So I say there's no way this happens. They're doing this to sort of just kind of keep the mystery up. There's no way he's not showing his face. Although it would be great for Pedro Pascal. It'd be like, get my stand-in in there and just have him do the body work. But I don't think that's going to happen, no matter how many parsecs he goes through.
Well, here on Parsec Passion, I'm going to guess that that helmet will come off as well. But I wouldn't be surprised if that helmet didn't come off until possibly episodes 8, 9, or 10.
Oh.
If they really, really wanted it to be a big reveal that somebody got the Mandalorian to get his helmet off, and tune in this week to see his face.
Oh my God, I completely disagree with you, and I think we should put a friendly wager on it.
All right.
I'd say it's off by the end of episode 2.
Okay, I'm saying not till the one of the final 3 episodes. That's when it's off. Listeners,
amazing.
Write us on our facebook.com/doublephq, Twitter and Instagram @doublephq. When is that mask coming off the Mandalorian? Who's right, Catfish, Bubba, or are you right? Do you know better than we do? You know, why don't we, since we're talking about what we've seen in the trailer, why don't we jump ahead and talk about these trailers, Catfish? Even though the show is called Mandalorian and that character is front and center on all this action, most of the sound and dialogue we hear in these trailers is from Werner Herzog.
As they go down the mighty Amazon. Oh, no, the Parsec.
The grizzly bear did attack Timothy Treadwell. So what have you thought of these trailers we've gotten so far? hopefully it's already apparent in my voice. They've got me so stoked. This seems to be the right tone I want. I keep going back to your mentioning of Rogue One. It really feels like that gritty world we could experience, and I'm very excited.
Well, I mean, I would caution you from thinking that it's going to be too gritty. I mean, you know, it's Star Wars after all, you know, I believe the first time I heard about someone wanting a movie to appeal to all four quadrants was for one of the Star Wars movies. Maybe it was Han Solo. So the quadrants are, it's essentially young, old, male, female. So they wanted to appeal to everybody.
I was about to say that's too restrictive.
We need more. We need five quadrants. Like, get us an extra quadrant. It's in the 12th parsec.
Pedro Pascal, get out there and get us another quadrant.
I'm excited too. I mean, it looks great. The action looks great. Mostly, I mean, what's kind of funny is for a new show, usually they're trying to give you an idea of the storyline. Mm-hmm. That's not really the sense here. I mean, the sense is there's kind of foreboding and he's a bounty hunter and sometimes that is good and sometimes that is bad.
It has me so hyped. We keep mentioning Werner Herzog, and we were mimicking his voice in the documentaries he's done. And I have to be honest, Grizzly Man, his documentary is one of the best documentaries I've ever seen. I loved that documentary by him. Do you have any other favorite Werner Herzog moments and or films of his?
I mean, I have to look at his. I mean, he has amazingly shown up for a quote-unquote serious filmmaker. He has shown up in some real, just a mess movies.
That's true.
Oh my God, I was just looking at his, he's directed 73 movies. Oh my goodness gracious.
So far, only 73 so far.
Oh my goodness, yes, okay. So, actually it's funny here, I'm looking at his acting, The Simpsons, Rick and Morty, Parks and Recreation. Wow, he has really done some good stuff.
He picks his roles carefully.
He sure does. What's funny is even though he's doing this serious here, he is used in all these cases to be kind of amusing, acting the same exact way.
Other characters we see in this trailer include Carl Weathers, who's playing a character known as Greef Karga. That's Greef, right. G-R-E-E-F, Karga with an A at the end. And do you have a favorite Carl Weathers moment from his long career? I'll go first and say all his appearances on Arrested Development just kill me. He's so funny. It's so great to see him. So I'm very excited about Greef Karga, a.k.a. Carl Weathers. And even though I can't remember if he's actually said anything in any of these trailers, just the one look, the shot they keep giving him where you would assume his character is looking at the Mandalorian and thinking, uh-oh. I really am excited about him being in this.
I mean, for me, I remember him from Arrested Development and feel like he should have done a lot more work because he was, I am not an Adam Sandler fan that much, but Happy Gilmore is a very funny movie and he was great in it. He really should have been working more, especially in comedy. He's got a light touch. And so that's my good grief, is his light touch, especially with his fake hand in Happy Gilmore.
Well, we're going to get to some good griefs as well as some grief beefs later on in the podcast. I want to talk about a couple more actors that we've seen in some of these trailers. A character we've seen in both trailers is a character named Cara Dune, who's played by Gina Carano. Ooh. Is Gina Carano, right?
Oh, boy. I wasn't aware of that.
Now, Gina Carano, was she a mixed martial arts fighter, Catfish?
Yes, she was a mixed martial arts
fighter. And she has made the transition to acting. She's to be sexist, she's very lovely. But what Catfish is getting at is that Catfish and I went to the theaters and saw her starring debut role in Haywire. And it was kind of rough. People have been very tough on her acting so far. And here she is, the biggest female name in The Mandalorian. Do you want to go deeper into your thoughts on Gina Carano.
The thing, and granted, that was her first movie. So you can say that. But also, I mean, you could say to yourself, well, okay, she's MMA, but the Mandalorian is not going to ask her to do too much. Even in the very little she's been asked to do in some things, hasn't been great. Hopefully she's gotten better and that they won't ask for too much. What that portends, though, is that they're looking for, you know, that they're interested more in action.
Oh, yes. And so we're going to hope that she brings the heat and the punches and the kicks and everything she's known for. Final actor I want to point out from these trailers is a character named Moff Gideon. That's Moff, the title, like Grand Moff Tarkin from the Star Wars A New Hope, played by Peter Cushing. This is Moff Gideon, played by the great actor Giancarlo Esposito. Many people more recently would know him from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad, where he was Gus Fring, the chicken man. So good. With a title like Moff, you would think he would be someone with Imperial sympathies. What do you think about Giancarlo Esposito, Catfish?
I've always really dug his acting, even before he was in Breaking Bad. And so I'm glad that that role kind of catapulted him. I find him to be a really interesting actor.
Now, the one name that we haven't mentioned since the beginning of the podcast is the executive producer, the person who came up with the idea of this television show, and the person who, because of his extensive work with Disney, was able to get it through. That's executive producer Jon Favreau. Many of us probably first learned of Jon Favreau, the actor, the movie Swingers, a movie he wrote to star himself with.
What, you're not gonna, what about Rudy?
Rudy, yeah, well, I never saw Rudy, sorry. I know he was in Rudy, that's how he met Vince Vaughn. I always remember, I first saw him in Swingers. But he has become a very powerful player in Hollywood, Catfish, directing many big budget things. And I'm going to list right now some of his directing credits. And so, Catfish, let's hear your thoughts on these and if they get you excited that this is from the mind of Jon Favreau. His most recent film he directed was a big hit. It was the live action, quote unquote, live action remake of The Lion King. Before that, he had done a live action remake of Disney's The Jungle Book. Before that, he made a very personal film, Chef. He made Cowboys and Aliens, the Daniel Craig Harrison Ford movie. He directed the first two Iron Man movie, the great Iron Man 1 and the not quite so good Iron Man 2. He directed Elf, a film so many people love. He directed another movie he made with Vince Vaughn as an actor entitled Maid. Catfish, what does this filmography tell you? What are your thoughts about Jon Favreau getting to executive produce and make the first Star Wars TV show?
Well, I mean, he's got a lot of enthusiasm for it. Obviously, Disney has a lot of trust in him. I did not see The Lion King nor The Jungle Book. I'm wondering if you saw either one of those and have a comment.
I do, and those live-action, almost beat-for-beat remakes, I think, are successful, but mainly because the films they were reproducing were successful. And so I think The Lion King, even though it's even closer to a shot-for-shot remake than The Jungle Book, I thought that was really good for what it was.
Mm. I hear great things about Chef. Iron Man was a great movie, as you said, and Iron Man 2 almost killed the Iron Man series. Elf is a great movie. So, I mean... Cowboys and Aliens, I did see, and I thought was okay. That was a strange choice to make that into that comic book into a movie. Not that successful. I don't know if that was his fault or not. But I mean, I guess looking at it, I don't say yes, amazing. But you know, he's worked.
Well, how about this? Does the fact that it's from him add any extra excitement to it, or is it just because it's Star Wars? Because it's Star Wars, it could have been directed by Tim Smith off the street, and you would be just as excited.
Yeah, I think I'm excited. What I'm interested in is that, you know, he's done some things that were sort of properties of others, so to speak. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that is that even though it's the Star Wars universe, it's a completely new story and everything. So I'm curious to see how that part of it will work out. You know, like you say, when you're doing like shot for shot of previous properties, you know, that's more, you know, kind of workmanlike rather than artistic.
I should point out many Star Wars fans are screaming at us right now that Jon Favreau voiced characters in the animated show Star Wars The Clone Wars, and since he became good friends with the creator and showrunner of those shows, Dave Filoni, those animated shows, and now Dave Filoni, he's hired to be one of the directors in season one, who will be directing this pilot we're all going to see on November 12th.
All right.
Now, Catfish, as we get to the end of each podcast, we decided to have some fun based around Carl Weathers' character's name, Grief, and that when we're reviewing the episodes at the end of each podcast, we're going to give you our good grief. That's our favorite moment from the episode and or favorite Carl Weathers moment in the episode, good grief. And we're also going to give you grief's beefs, the worst thing, the possible troubling thing in the episode, or anytime anybody pissed off Carl Weathers. So, Catfish, you already said your good grief based around Happy Gilmore. I can hear the laughter in your voice as you say it.
Yeah, that's what it has to be. And my grief's beef is with Pawsick. Because as I was watching the trailer, it's going along and Werner's voice is really – it's selling to me and everything. And then just the way he said Pawsick – I just – all of a sudden I was like really just jarred out of it. And so it was just very strange. I'm sure like when he got to it, Werner's like, what is this word? Pawsick? Is this made up word? I'm already in second language.
Well, yeah. This is going to be a stretch. You know, we're tough on Gina Carano. You know, his acting – he's got to do some heavy lifting considering he's doing a scene with guys with a bunch of other actors who are all wearing masks and helmets.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'll go ahead and say my good grief is these trailers. I love them. They get me so excited when the Razor's Crest, which is the Mandalorian ship, is flying over some of these planets, especially that one that looks like cracked sand and cracked earth. I thought that is beautiful. That is incredible that we're getting this as a TV show. My grief's beefs are with anybody who thinks the Mandalorian's going to take off his helmet before the final three episodes of the season. Each week, we're also going to want to hear from you. So after you watch the episode, once again, tweet at us, Instagram us, tell us what your grief's beef is, or your good grief, the stuff you loved, at DoublePHQ on Twitter and Instagram, Facebook.com/DoublePHQ. All right, Catfish. Bounty hunting is a dangerous profession, would you not agree?
Yes, but that is why I am happy to have my passion for Pawsick.
We'll get ready to please subscribe and like the podcast, and we'll talk to you after we've seen episode one.
Pawsick passion.
Pawsick passion. Catfish, do you have a Pawsick passion for this preview podcast?
Yes, I am going to double P Pawsick passionate for The Mandalorian and Gina Carano. Now, my second ship that I'd like to do would be Gina Carano and Werner Herzog. She's like, say it again. Pawsick passion.
I've been known to love women on 12 Pawsicks at one moment. When I'm in light speed, I'm able to love multiple people. Okay.
He said, I've got Pawsick 15 syphilis.